The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Friday Space Show program. Also, a very Merry Christmas to all of you. And please remember, there is no Christmas Space Show program. We resume the Space Show Monday evening rather than Monday afternoon with a special open lines program, 7 p.m. California time. So for today, please jot down our toll-free number. It is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we don't use call screeners, so when you call, be patient. We'll answer the line as soon as possible and bring you up on air as soon as possible. For those of you not wanting to use the toll-free line, you can use email. It is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember that all of our programs are trademarked and copyrighted, but you do have permission to download the MP3s and share them and pass them around to help get the word out as to why space and the subjects of our Space Show program are so important for everyone. But please don't do anything commercial with the programs, no edits to them, you know, no private YouTube channels or anything like that. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And we appreciate your honoring that request. And then we do podcast, and you can find our podcast on iTunes and on Microsoft Zune and a host of other places around the net. And we thank Andrew over at Gigadial.net. That's the company that hosts our podcast. We thank him for his services and wish him a very Merry Christmas as well and a Happy New Year. If you have any podcasting questions, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do visit our website, which is thespaceshow.com, because you'll find our comprehensive newsletter. It is uploaded every Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening, California time. And it has the full guest bios. It has all of the information about the show. And it's the only place where we have a future events section for the Space Show. And we're booking already into February, for example. And then if we have to make any special announcements or change the schedule, you'll find it first on the website newsletter. So do check it out from time to time to stay current. And then you can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter that goes out early Monday morning via email. And it's very, very short. Will not clutter up your inbox, I promise you that. It's 1 or 2 lines about the week's programs, and that is it. And then everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or easily download these shows. We do have a Space Show store. You'll see it up at the top of our website. It's called Space Show Gear. Please do visit it and check it out. And above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation. org. And we can't do this program without your generous and very kind support. We thank all of you who have been supporting us and who will be. Remember, if you pay U.S. taxes, you get a tax deduction. And if you pay California taxes, you also get a California deduction. We're currently wrapping up our end of the year 2011 fundraising campaign. In each archive program I'm doing, I put the URL in for our annual fundraising letter. Please check it out. And we appreciate any support that you can give us for the Space Show. And then do remember, we are partially sponsored by Secure World Foundation. They work for secure, sustainable, and peaceful uses of outer space. And hopefully all of this contributes to global stability on Earth. And you can get much more information about this fine organization by visiting their website, which is secureworldfoundation.org. So do check it out. So I want to tell you about today's program, and I'm very excited to introduce to you Dr. James Hughes. Dr. Hughes has his doctorate in sociology from the University of Chicago, and he has taught health policy, medical sociology, bioethics, and research methods at the University of Chicago, Northwestern, the University of Connecticut, and is now at Trinity College. He emphasizes the ability to convey ideas to public audiences through accessible writing and oral presentations. But my friend Roger Lanius, who you've heard on the show many, many times from the Smithsonian, did a blog post a couple of weeks back about a book that he wrote, Citizen Cyborg, Why Democratic Societies Must Respond to the Redesigned Human of the Future. And this is a provocative work by a medical ethicist, and that is Dr. Hughes. And he argues that technologies pushing the boundaries of humanness can radically improve our quality of life if they are controlled democratically. And on, but if you'll remember, we've had several space show guests that talk about these kinds of issues in terms of how can we change humans to actually survive and go into long-term spaceflight, go to Mars and other things. And we can extrapolate from Dr. Hughes's book, but some of the ethical and medical and other issues are very, very similar. So I believe this is a really good way to sort of start winding down 2011 and to talk with him about his very applicable and very fine book, which I recommend to all of you. Dr. Hughes, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Oh, I'm very good today and glad to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your book and what it's about and its premise and some of the issues that you think are paramount in it? You know, I read some of the issues that Roger Lanius put in his blog, and we can get into some of those issues later on. But tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the book grew out of the unusual situation I found myself in the 90s, which was that when I started teaching bioethics at the University of Chicago and discovered that my orientation towards bioethics and medical progress was different from what a lot of bioethicists had at the time. And I was also editing a journal called Eco-Socialist Review. I was engaged as a socialist activist in trying to figure out the relationship between socialist politics and green politics, environmental politics. So in my academic work as a bioethicist and in my political work, I was running up against an anti-technology bias on the part of a lot of progressives, kind of creeping hostility to the Enlightenment that came from a lot of different sources. It came from certain strands of postmodern thought, of feminism, environmentalism, and so on, that had decided that reason, technology, science were part of the problem, not part of the solution. And that led me to then discover that I was probably a transhumanist because of my belief with transhumanists that human enhancement was both acceptable and desirable, that it was possible for humans to live longer than they currently do and to have greater cognitive capacities than they currently do, and that this would not be, you know, a terrible thing. This would, in fact, be a good thing, and that makes you transhumanist if you think those things. And so I started to connect with transhumanists in the 90s, but what I found was that many transhumanists had libertarian politics in the sense that they were not only libertarian around individual liberty, the right to use technologies, the right to control your reproduction, drug decriminalization, those kinds of issues, which, of course, I agree with, but also libertarian in the sense that they were hostile to democracy and the state in the whole, and so they didn't believe in things like the FDA or universal health care or the UN, a lot of things that I think are good ideas. So that started a problem for me. I was looking for folks that I agreed with on these kinds of issues, and it is a project that I continue to work on. But I began to go back in political history and discover that the the Enlightenment project that began several hundred years ago was really what I was trying to rediscover, that it was in the Enlightenment thinkers who said that humankind could control its affairs through science and reason, and that those affairs, you know, that our economic affairs, our political affairs, and even our bodies and our health could be rationally redesigned to better pursue our own ends. And that kind of consistent thread I began to pull out of contemporary politics, the people who were working on those connections. So Citizen Cyborg was a distillation of my thinking at the time around what a social democratic version of transhumanist politics would look like, what the issues would be. And it was also a parsing out of the various factions that existed in the mid-2000s around what I called then biopolitics, the politics that had begun to emerge between the Christian right, Greens, people in the President's Council for Bioethics, Francis Fukuyama and Leon Kass and so on, critics of human enhancement, and then the various factions within transhumanist or techno-progressive camps as well. That those issues have since evolved quite a bit and rapidly, and one of the things that's happened is that the term that I was promoting in the book, democratic transhumanism, has been superseded by what we now talk about as techno-progressive politics. And I think there is, you know, a lot of progress that's been made in terms of teasing out, you know, what a techno-progressive politics around, for instance, disability looks like. Why, you know, that was one of the issues that we addressed in that book, that there were people in the disability rights community who were critical of human enhancement because they saw it as the kind of ableism that they were afraid of, and since then there's been quite a bit of progress in trying to draw out the connections between disability politics and transhumanist politics. So it's just one of the many examples of the kind of issues that book addressed, and that we've made a lot of progress around. So.
Why do you think there is such a disconnect between the reality of today, which we're here where we are a lot through the advancement of science and technology, and then so many people either fear it or reject it, or in many ways would just as soon revert back to a time before we had a lot of advanced technologies, but they're all benefiting from it.
Well, the reaction against the Enlightenment started immediately, you know, that people, for political reasons and for religious reasons, psychological reasons, just wanted to romanticize the past, argue that some of the side effects of science and technology were not just things that needed to be fixed in terms of the detail, but also that all of science and technology should be rejected as a consequence. So in the past, that used to just be a reactionary side of politics and culture. You know, the church reacted that way, of course. Aristocrats reacted that way to the emerging bourgeoisie. What happened in the 20th century is that after World War II, you saw a number of reactions on the part of political progressives who joined in that critique. It wasn't just people who rejected. You know, it wasn't just Tolkien rejecting the growth of cities and the emergence of technology with his reactionary Lord of the Rings kind of fantasies. It was suddenly the bomb. In DDT, it was the machine, as you know, represented by hippie kind of left politics of the 60s, and they rejected the machine. And big corporations became associated with science and technology. And so it really a broad-based critique of science and technology spread, not just from the reactionary quarters of society, but also to the progressives. And so one of the very few people who were left, you know, defending in a full-throated way science and technology were the apologists for selfishness, corporatism, militarism, and so forth, which is kind of a weak base to have. Now, I take some of those criticisms seriously, and I think there are things to be said about the importance of communities and all the reasons that people were anxious about the growth of science and technology have some merit to them. But on the other hand, I think we need to return to that optimism of the Enlightenment, chastened perhaps by our no longer having a kind of naive optimism about all those things, but that still, if we look back, as Steven Pinker has just done in his wonderful book about the decline of violence, if you look back at the progress that's been made over the last couple hundred of years of eliminating slavery and establishing human well-being and extending lifespans and the decline of the number of us who would have died from violent death, all of this can be attributed to progress of the Enlightenment on the whole and partly to the growth of science and technology.
You do have an email question from Robert, who's listening out of San Diego. And Robert says, I would imagine many people might, out of fear, or perhaps they have a motivation, think that if you're trying to modify humans or do something special with them, you're playing with and acting like you're God, and that's not what humans are supposed to do. Or is that what we're supposed to do? If we have free will, then if the technology allows us to do things that some might think equal our playing God, isn't that within our capability and our choices? And isn't that okay? Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do it. I think it's all very confusing. I'm hoping perhaps that you can add a bit of clarity to what I'm talking about.
Hmm. Well, I'm not a believer, but I've always been very engaged with questions of theology and religion, I guess kind of like Christopher Hitchens. Although I don't believe in God, I consider myself a rebel against the belief in God. But at any rate, there is a great theologian named Ted Peters who wrote a book called Playing God a couple years ago. He is out there in California at Lutheran Pacific Theological Seminary. And in his book, Playing God, he argues that Christians who argue against human genetic modification in particular in that book, but in general against any kind of technological intervention on the grounds that it's playing God, have a fundamentally unchristian theological view. In other words, if you believe that God is like the Greek God, that there's a God up on a mountain someplace, and if you just were powerful enough, if you were hubristic enough, hubris being a Greek word, if you were hubristic enough to be able to march up Olympus and throw Zeus off of his throne and take away his powers, that is hubris. That is the belief that you can challenge God. That's not the kind of God that Christians believe in. Christians believe in a God that is in everything, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. And you can't ever challenge that kind of God. So the idea of hubris is fundamentally an unchristian idea. There's no way in which any aggregation of power or becoming more intelligent or living a longer life could be possibly hubristic against God or taking on the powers of God. So if not, then many Christians and many theologians of other traditions have asked throughout time, well, what is exactly God's purpose for man? Is it just that we remain children forever and never use the powers which we apparently have been given, the power of reason, for instance? Or are we expected to progress in some way, not just stay in the garden, but figure out what our role is supposed to be and become more mature in that role? And that view has been considered by the church at times quite heretical. There's Pelagianism and other advocates of this kind of view that human beings could be more perfect and could progress who have been, you know, considered heresies. But nonetheless, it is one of the views within Orthodox Christianity historically. And if I were to be a Christian or believe in God, I think that I would probably believe that God gave us reason for a reason, and that one of those reasons was to become intelligent enough and wise enough to understand the plan, whatever the plan might be. And clearly we don't understand the plan yet, so we would have to become more intelligent and long-lived and powerful in order to enact that role. There's many aspects of this argument. The idea that immortality is somehow a violation of God's will, I've never really understood that either. I mean, like, if you believe that the universe is created and has a specific deadline that it's going to meet when it comes to a close and, you know, heaven on earth gets created or whatever, well, obviously, trying to stay alive longer would have no effect on that at all. If you just be alive when it happens. If you meet your maker alive, they get the judgment alive, it's not going to change the fact that you get judged. So, you know, the idea that any of the technologies that we talk about are somehow a violation of God's plan has never really been comprehensible to me.
I have a son with the genetic illness cystic fibrosis. So there's probably 30,000 to 40,000 Americans at any given time that are directly either as family members or having the genetic problem affected by it, and a lot more, of course, worldwide. And I can't think of anyone, including the doctors and the caregivers. And this transcends whatever political beliefs they may have or religious beliefs they may have, that wouldn't absolutely welcome the ability to genetically modify what causes cystic fibrosis to end the disease and to end the unbelievable cost in medical care and the high cost of genetically engineered drugs that are needed to keep these people alive and to give them a quality of life. I cannot even comprehend anybody opposing that technology. There might be somebody out there that does, but all of us, you know, the families and the caregivers, we look forward to the technology, the use of stem cell research, anything that scientists and doctors can get their hands on, that can make a huge difference in this genetic disease, which is still fatal, although the life expectancy has gone way, way up over the years. So if we're willing to accept genetic tinkering at that level, it seems to me that to say, well, it's okay there but not okay here, kind of is hypocritical, to say the least. So,
there are people who argue against the fixing of disabilities, and there are two basic arguments that they make. One is the completely absurd, to my view, argument that if we start fixing disabilities and diseases, that we will eliminate all human suffering, and that we are ennobled by our suffering, we learn from our suffering, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, well, they don't have anyone affected with a disability, let me tell you.
Exactly. And most people like that wouldn't apply it to muscular dystrophy. But when you start talking about ADD or kind of lesser disabilities, then they start using that kind of a logic. I think that that's incredibly psychologically naive. And we could have a world without cancer, stroke, muscular dystrophy,
et cetera, yeah.
And still have lots of things to learn from life. We would still have the disappointment of unrequited love. We would still have the inability to accomplish our life, et cetera, et cetera. So, even if we do learn from adversity, and I think we do to a certain extent, we'll have adversity. The second argument is that disability argument that I referenced earlier, which is the notion that somehow trying to fix disabilities implies that you hate people with disabilities. And you as a father and I as a father of two kids one of my children has Tourette syndrome, for instance, and I have suffered with her the difficulty of trying to live her life with that particular disability. And if I had had the option to fix it, I would not have considered it an act of not loving my daughter. I would have considered it my obligation, because I love my daughter, to have fixed her Tourette's at any point, and I hope it will be fixed in the future, as does she. So the idea that, you know, because we want to see less Down syndrome in the world, or we want to see less muscular dystrophy, we hate people with Downs, or we hate people with muscular dystrophy, is just incredibly offensive and wrongheaded. And no government in the world says that they are benign about the amount of disability that will be in their populations in the future. Every government in the world is trying mightily, with the wholehearted support of all of their citizens, to reduce the incidence of disability, and it's not because they hate their people. It's because they love their people, or that people love themselves and want there to be less disability. So, at any rate, yeah.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. You know, another thing, and then we'll take the break. In long-term spaceflight, like if we wanted to go to Mars, there are a lot of problems that are in the what are called the human factors area, where humans are just not really suited for long terms without gravity and radiation exposure and emotional breakdown and things like that. And these are really, really hard challenges to overcome. But there are a few people out there that talk about genetic modification so that humans can cope better with lower gravity or radiation or something like that. And while the technology is clearly not here today, many scientists and doctors, well, I shouldn't say many, but some, think that this is a distinct possibility and a valid area of research. Yet, if you go into the broader communities and NASA and all of that, they won't talk about genetic modification. And they keep thinking, well, we'll develop shielding. We'll develop a pill you can take to make you radiation resistant. We'll have better protocols for exercise for microgravity problems. And try to get NASA people to really talk about genetic modification and things like that. These are really taboo subjects, even as 2011 draws to a close. So it doesn't even get a fair hearing, except from a handful of researchers that are considered on the fringe. So I guess what I'm asking is this kind of research fringe across the board, or am I in a field where it just happens to be fringe for a lot of, I guess, internal or unique problems where people don't want to address genetic modification of a person?
Well, in the first place, I would recommend that you bring on Paul Root Wolpe, who is the chief bioethicist for NASA. And I know that Paul's views on this subject are similar to my own, which is that human genetic modification and enhancement is inevitable, and that one of the things, as you point out, that it could be applied to is facilitating human exploration of space. So at least the chief bioethicist for NASA would probably endorse the discussion of that particular topic. I understand, as you point out, that NASA, for political reasons, doesn't want to scare the horses and talk about, there's a certain kind of continuity question. If we change ourselves so radically when we go into space, would it really be humanity exploring space? You know, if we replaced our legs with arms so that we were, had four arms in space in a weightless environment, replaced our bones with steel so that they wouldn't erode away under the force of not having any gravity to keep them strong. You know, there's a certain number of changes that we go through, and then all of a sudden people on Earth no longer relate to the beings that are out there anymore. And that's part of this challenge of transhumanism, posthumanism, about how we construct a new identity around what the humans are and what we can become, so that people understand that this is still, part of who we are. At any rate, yes, I think you're right. In the long run, the question isn't genetic modification in order to facilitate space. It's that it doesn't make any sense to send bags full of meat and water out into space with brains nestled inside of them. We can have far more efficient exploration of space by stuffing consciousness down into nano-sized computers that would have the capacity, when they get to the other end of whatever this journey might be, unwrap themselves, start building something on the other end. And so that's, I think, in the long run, the kind of Von Neumann idea, the notion that the most logical way to explore space is to send out nano probe-sized devices that then have the capacity to unwrap themselves into larger devices on the other end. That's probably how the universe has been explored in the past by other civilizations, and that's probably how we'll end up doing it ourselves. But at least for solar exploration, the colonization and terraforming of Mars and the colonization of asteroids and so forth, we'll probably still be in our meat bodies, but hopefully genetically modified, as you point out.
You know, if we were able to colonize Mars and humans could do it, and they were there for 5 years or 7 years, and they didn't have any modification, I suspect if they came back to Earth, they would be so culturally and so humanly out of sync with what they had left behind that they would be like different species almost altogether. I think that experience would absolutely modify them in ways we can't even conceive of. So to think that they're going to remain Earth-like humans, even if we don't genetically do anything, and they're going to go live on another world like that for 5 years or 7 years or whatever, and then come back. Boy, talk about culture shock and what they would be like. I can't even imagine it.
I don't know about cultural drift, because I know that NASA already has plans to create an interplanetary IP system, or in other words, an internet for the planet. And I think that you could probably have quite a bit of back-and-forth cultural communication in order to keep everybody on Mars integrated with what's happening here. But the biological drift, when you get people living in Mars gravity, I think, 60% of Earth gravity, and then lunar gravity, of course, almost nothing, and that, their bones, their physiology would change fundamentally. Even if they weren't genetically modified, if they were not genetically modified, in order to be able to reenter Earth would be very difficult for most people who have been living in those kinds of environments. It'd probably be bad for their health in other ways.
You have another question, and then we'll take a break. This is Anthony, and he's in Poole, England, over across the ocean. And Merry Christmas to you, Anthony. He says, great discussion. A Tourette's sufferer who was considering ending her life has had her symptoms switched off thanks to a revolutionary new treatment. British brain surgeons placed two electrodes into her skull and turned on the current for 40 minutes. And her symptoms instantly faded. And then he gave me a long URL for this in the Telegraph. I think if someone suffers in life with a deficiency for a long period, most people's choice would be to have treatment if it makes the quality of life better. And I certainly would agree with Anthony, as would, I think, any rational person.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Deep brain stimulation, of course. It's not something that one undertakes lightly, because you don't want to open up anybody's brain unless they have a very severe problem. And some people with Tourette's, of course, do have, constant seizures or inability to have a job or do anything that they want to do, and so you might consider it in those cases. But what the deep brain stimulation for depression, for Tourette's, for Parkinson's disease, all kinds of things that are being explored and treated successfully with those kinds of electrode treatment, what they point towards is that very shortly we're going to have nano-robotic probes that you won't have to cut into somebody's head in order to get them up into the brain. And you'll be able to get them up there through the blood-brain barrier, doing what they need to do at the nanometer size, and those will facilitate the treatment of all kinds of brain diseases and the eventual cognitive enhancement applications they could have for people without any disease at all.
We're going to go ahead and take our first break here. So, listeners, we'll be back in about 3 minutes with Dr. Hughes. Don't go anywhere. Coming right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, listeners. And today our guest is Dr. James Hughes. We're talking about his recent book, Citizen Cyborg. And Lonnie is in Tucson, Arizona. And Lonnie says, I'm wondering if you can state what the bioethical issues might be. For example, if we were evolved enough or advanced enough to start doing human experiments or maybe even animal experiments in some of the changes that you've been talking about for humans, what would you have to set out in the protocols to get permission to be able to do such experiments? What would you have to identify? What would you have to disclose? What would the issues be? Can you do that at this stage of our development?
Well, whenever you do medical research, it proceeds in a series of stages. First, we try medical ideas on animals because they have a different moral status, and I think for most animals they should have a different moral status. I'm posed, and the organization that I lead now, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, we have a position on research on apes. We're opposed to research on great apes, chimpanzees and gorillas and so forth. We think that they should have a higher moral status than other kinds of lab animals, so rats. We don't have a problem with that kind of research. But at any rate, medical research starts with animal models, and to the extent possible, those animals, we hope, have human physiological responses, medical, hormonal, physiological responses to whatever therapy we're trying to explore. Now, in the case of genetic enhancement, it's kind of interesting that one of the things that you would like to do is introduce, you know, novel genes. And so if you're actually doing that into an animal, you're changing them into something closer to into the kind of human that you want to become yourself. So with apes, one of the few kinds of research on apes that we think would be acceptable and one of the interesting ethical questions for the future is cognitive enhancement research, because you're actually, at least at a certain point, you would not be causing them harm. You would actually be doing them benefit by making them smarter.
Can I stop you there for a minute?
Sure.
So making them smarter and not causing them harm is a human value we're placing on the ape, but we have no idea if the ape thinks that's harm or not, do we? Or am I being too extreme here?
All values at this point are human values. If we want to ever hopefully we'll find other species in the future, and if we don't find them, we'll create them. And those other species that we find or create may have their own value systems, but animals don't have value systems. All values that we know of are human values, so that's just inescapable. Yes, we have a human conversation about what's a benefit and what's a harm, and as we were saying earlier, there are some humans who disagree that it's a benefit not to have muscular dystrophy or it's a benefit not to have cancer, but most humans think it is. Most humans also think having greater cognitive capacities is a benefit and not a harm, and so we just hope that the apes, when they get those capacities, agree with us. But right now, they don't have any opinions about the matter. So at any rate, the medical research steps, you go through animal research. We would like to skip over the ape stage. And then you have, when you approach human trials with drugs and devices, you have a cost-benefit analysis of which humans the benefits and the costs really are appropriate for at the level of risk that the device is at. So if it's a low-risk device, then you might have a broader swath of people that you would say these folks have enough of a disability to try this particular thing. When it's something like deep brain stimulation, where you have to cut somebody's brain open, well, then you have to have a very severe case of untreatable depression or Parkinson's or Tourette's syndrome that's completely disabling. If it's a chemotherapy drug that's going to make all your hair fall out, make you puke, it might even kill you, well, you have to be an untreatable cancer to have that kind of a risk-benefit ratio make any sense. So you start some of these therapies with people who have very severe problems so that it makes some ethical sense. And then once you understand the risks and the benefits and the toxicity, then you begin to expand who can use particular drugs and devices. So in the case of human genetic modification, we would start with animals, start changing their genes, see what the consequences are. Then we would, as we're already doing, human gene therapy for people with, you know, boy in the bubble syndrome who don't have any immunological function, or hemophilia has been recently treated with gene therapy. You wouldn't start gene therapy on humans on lesser things. You know, ADD is not something you're going to treat with gene therapy yet until you have a very good understanding of what the causes, the consequences of these kinds of therapies might be. In the past, we've seen, for instance, that gene therapy has caused cancer because of the way it was being conducted. It was blowing apart genes that shouldn't have been blown apart and causing people to get cancers. So, and it can cause severe immunological reactions as well. So we want to understand all those consequences before we proceed with any of these things.
Cheryl is in Seattle, and Cheryl says, speaking of these kinds of experiments, David mentioned cystic fibrosis. Years ago, they tried gene transplants on cystic fibrosis patients, and the results were so bad that one patient actually died, and they stopped the gene therapy efforts on that. So there can be some pretty adverse ramifications for doing these experiments. And I'm just wondering how they got permission to do that. I guess the person was so sick or so ill that the choices were not good to begin with on either side. The other thing I know from having read the literature on this, because I have a relative with cystic fibrosis, is that years ago they were able to develop lungs in a mouse that modeled cystic fibrosis, and the mouse model has been a main research model for human cystic fibrosis lung problems. I suppose to modify a mouse that way, they had to go through some level of ethical review, even for a mouse. Is that probably correct?
Well, there are regulations that govern how we treat animals in labs, and also the property questions around genetically modified animals. One of the first patented animals was an onco mouse, a mouse that was especially prone to cancer. But all kinds of mouse models have been developed, mice with particular kinds of genes to model brain diseases and physiological diseases. We've also moved on to pigs with more human histological systems because pigs are a little bit more similar to us. And I think that all that is would greatly facilitate these kinds of what we call transgenic animal models would greatly facilitate research before we, so that we understand things before we get to their applications to humans. The other thing that's going to change medicine quite a bit in the coming decades is the growth of what we call in silico models, the notion of creating sophisticated models of how the genes and hormones and biochemistry of the human body works so that we just do something to a computer, run it through a zillion trials in a matter of seconds, and figure out what kind of drug or gene therapy is best to apply or what its consequences might be. And that will greatly facilitate medical research.
Randy in Denver, Colorado, says, what are your thoughts on human cloning? I would imagine that at some point humans could be cloned, and then maybe the clones go into outer space, and the clones are modified, and that's not the same as modifying a human. I guess I'm far-reaching here, but how does cloning work in your book and in your work?
Well, in the first place, clones would be humans. They would have exactly the same moral and ethical status as anybody else. Cloning is basically creating twins. And nobody, you know, there used to be cultures that when twins were born, they would bash their heads against rocks because they said only animals have litters. But I don't think there are any cultures today that consider twins an unholy abomination. And so if we were to start cloning, they would be twins, and they would have exactly the same rights as everybody else. So I don't think there's any reason to send them into space rather than the person that they're cloned from. The question around cloning is really a question of reproductive rights. If a parent has a reason to want to have a child, we don't currently interrogate them. If you do it by the whoops, I did it again method that the vast majority of humans employ today, nobody gets to ask them, why did you want to have that child? What was your psychological motivation? You know, or do you have unrealistic expectations about that child? Blah, blah, blah. No, they just get to have kids. And then if you go to a clinic and you say, well, I can't have kids in a normal way, so I'm going to spend $30,000, go through a set of procedures that give me a 20% chance of having a kid through artificial reproductive technology, in vitro fertilization or whatever. Again, in the United States, you generally don't get too much of an interrogation. Now, the problem comes in that if you tell them, well, I'm really interested, I've got two boys, and I would rather have a daughter this time, and I want to use this $30,000 pop here to have a daughter, then people start getting antsy about it. Oh, now you've got expectations about the kind of child. Well, if you just went back, if you didn't have to go to the clinic in the first place, and you just kept having kids until you had a daughter, no one has any right to say anything about that the first place, you know, right, in our society. We used to get really antsy about people's reproductive decision-making. That was called eugenics. We used to say that certain kinds of people with certain kinds of genes shouldn't be having kids, or that they had bad reasons for having kids, or that women who were too poor should be sterilized. And we decided we weren't going to do that anymore. So basically, when it comes to cloning, I think it should, once it's safe, and this gets back to this, how do we determine if it's safe to deploy? And it's not safe to deploy right now. We know that the success rate of cloning, the current cloning methods for apes and humans is extremely poor. It would probably take about 200 experiments just to get a viable pregnancy out of a clone, and then there would be unknown and a high risk of genetic anomalies. But once it's safe, it should just be another part of the reproductive choices that every parent has available to them.
Is it safe for animals at this point, or are we still a ways from that? If I want to clone my dog, is that a safe bet if I wanted to spend the money to do it?
Yeah, there was that company Savings and Clone that was offering to clone people's dogs. Now, again, people got anxious about, you know, who's going to be spending $50,000 to clone their dogs? Well, who cares? I mean,
who cares if they want to do it?
Yeah, it's not as if you're doing any harm. PETA apparently was upset about this idea. But it's like, okay, maybe that $50,000 that person was going to spend would have been better spent on spaying and neutering dogs or something else other than, you know, getting a clone of your beloved, you know, dog. But it's not, you know, I've never thought animal cloning had any ethical consequences. And the only ethical ramifications of human cloning are, as I said, the safety and efficacy question that I don't think parents should use reproductive technologies that impose high genetic or health risks in their children.
I sent my dog's ashes to space.
Oh, that's nice.
And, you know, there's some people who think it's bizarre and weird, but what the hell, you know, if that's what you want to do. But the interesting thing is when I first did it, I've done it a couple of times, when I first did it, we weren't allowed to talk about it because putting the pet's ashes on the same rocket flight where human ashes were, there was a grave concern that the families of the humans would be grossly offended. But I think there's an enormous amount of society fear and dark ages about all of this. And, in fact, we often talk on the Space Show about the rise in sort of mysticism and, you know, cultures that, you know, reject science and sort of evolve, not black magic, but magic, you know, kind of things, anti-science. It seems to be on the rise in the country. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, as a sociologist, I've been aware for a long time that that most educated people are woefully unaware and ignore the vast proportion of the American and the world population that believe crazy, superstitious ideas. Not, you know, just setting aside traditional religious concepts, the percent that believes that, you know, in politics we see it, you know, the craziness today, the people who believe that the president is a Kenyan and a socialist or a Muslim or whatever, despite any evidence to the contrary, the percent who believe in ghosts and EST and, you know, all kinds of superstitions like that. It's never been a surprise to me. I've got my eye firmly on that kind of survey data. I think that this is the unfinished business of the Enlightenment, that getting people to take their own rationality seriously, to respect themselves enough to subject themselves to scrutiny their own and figure out whether they're believing things for good reasons or bad reasons. This has been a long and slow process, and if we were to compare the world's population today to where it was 100 years ago, we'd see there has been a lot of progress, in all kinds of rational areas. There's a lot of distance still to go. Unfortunately, one of the huge problems from a sociological point of view is that irrational people around the world tend to outbreed rational people. So it's like, you know, you're constantly pushing the ball up the hill because rational people look at whether it makes sense to have a lot of kids, and they say, no, in fact, it doesn't. And the irrational people are thinking that God told them that they had to have a brood of a dozen, and so there's a lot more irrational people popping out into the world than rational people every generation.
Andrea in Dallas, Texas says, if you could look at maybe one singular event that has done more to propel science along the lines of what you're talking about, would that be the ability to have mapped the human genome?
Well, that, of course, greatly sped things up. Science is just a huge, long, interconnected process, human process, and there's really no one event that contributes any, you know, iota progress more than any other, I think. I mean, the mapping of the genome was a process that involved labs all over the world for a decade, and famously a race between one private firm and the government labs that were involved in that. So if that wasn't one event, and it's still not really completed, because all we did 10 years ago was map one genome, and now we're in the process of mapping millions and millions of genomes of every species on the planet, genomes of every kind of human on the planet, and then backtracking all that data to diseases and abilities, and so that we can figure out how that all works. And so that's still an ongoing process. But yes, of course, the ability to decode and map genetic information has been a huge step forward.
You used the term bioluddite. What do you mean by it?
Well, the Luddite movement, originally, that term came out of a reaction of textile manufacturers in England in the early part of the 19th century, who, when industrial looms started to be used, a lot of those small artisan mom-and-pop kind of textile firms went out of business. And so the movement started in England of going around and smashing these new industrial looms. And they, when they were asked who was leading this movement, they said General Ned Ludd. And that was a mythical leader for them. And a lot of Luddites were hanged because they were engaging in industrial arson. And the aristocrats who owned those new firms didn't like that very much. And they were a heroic movement in their own right. But the basic idea of Luddism is you take a problem, which is structural unemployment being created by technological progress, and you blame the technology instead of the society. And you blame the fact that, you know, England didn't have unemployment insurance at the time. They didn't have government-subsidized educational retraining for workers to enter new kinds of industries. There were all kinds of social issues that that eventually have been addressed in industrial societies, so that workers who lose their jobs because of technological change don't go penniless and starve. And that's the way to address those problems, not to smash the machine. So Luddism is essentially the logical error that many people fall into when they see a technology and it's related to some kind of social problem. They blame the technology instead of the society and the politics and the economics around that technology. So in the case of bioluddites, people get anxious, for instance, about genetic modification of children or about ADD drugs or whatever, because they think that parents have overly perfectionist expectations about their children, and this is going to commodify the relationships between parents and children, blah, blah, blah. And so they think, oh, well, if we ban ADD drugs or if we ban genetic therapies for kids in the future, then this will somehow fix that problem. No, it doesn't fix the problem at all. Parents have always had expectations for their children. Parents have always had financial motivations to have or not have children. In fact, those were much more extreme motivations when we had farms instead of banning child labor. And today, you know, a child is basically a luxury consumer item. When you had, when you were a farmer, you had as many kids as you possibly could because you could shove them out the door and get them working in the field. Today, you don't have any of those financial motivations, and so what's changed about having children is that they're luxury consumer items, and that's why people want to have a few very high quality ones instead of a dozen ones with strong backs. At any rate, you know, bioluddites, no matter what issue they see a reason to ban biological technology, biotechnology, neurotechnology, instead of fixing social problems that they really should be more concerned with.
Is that is bioluddite a movement? Is it on the rise?
Well, when I wrote Citizen Cyborg back 6 years ago, there had been an emergence of a number of organizations on the right and the left that were bioluddite, and there had been a number of attempts to create bioluddite alliances of people on the right and the left. So people, for instance, feminists and environmentalists who are pro-choice or otherwise, you know, they didn't have a problem with stem cell research, those kinds of things, but they were opposed to human enhancement technology, getting together with people on the religious right who oppose biotechnologies like stem cells because they think they violate the rights of the fetus or embryo, or because they think they're playing God, or You know, they think that C.S. Lewis warned that this would be a form of hubris or, you know, whatever reason they come to. But so there were these efforts to create these unholy alliances from the right and the left by the Luddites. Those alliances have fallen apart in the last 6 years, and a lot of the biopolitics that was swirling around the Bush Bioethics Council that was led by Leon Taft dissipated once Obama appointed a much more technocratic bioethics group, and who have been doing great work. They have issued excellent reports on synthetic biology and its risks and benefits, and recently a report on human subjects research that we were just talking about, how you ensure that research on humans is safe. Those are excellent topics to address, and I'm glad that they're doing that work. The Bush Bioethics Council was really getting a lot of people dander up about human enhancement, though, because that was one of their special fixations. And so I would say that the biopolitics has really gone underground in recent years. At the same time, what happened in the last 6 years is that a lot of liberal bioethicists who in the past would have been much more equivocal about human enhancement, genetic modification, those kinds of issues, were forced by the growth of the bioluddites to come out of the closet. And so there has been a much more explicit kind of drawing of line in bioethics, biopolicy, between bioliberals who are defending human rights to use these technologies and what we now call bioconservatives as opposed to bioluddites. Bioluddites was always a term that was more of a hand grenade than a descriptor. But bioconservatives is what a lot of people, I think, would ascribe to themselves, that they are conservative about the application of these technologies and they are anxious about the safety and efficacy concerns in ways that bioliberals usually aren't. So.
I would have never thought of some of these questions that listeners are asking. This is Charlene in New York City, and she says, I must have another disconnect going on here. Isn't plastic surgery, breast augmentation, et cetera, human enhancement, or is that just such a different category that the people who believe in all of that stuff don't have any conflicts if they oppose human enhancement at the levels you're talking about on the show today? To me, you're modifying the human. You're trying to enhance for probably beauty or personal reasons. I don't get the big difference.
Well, and of course, vaccination is a modification, an unnatural modification to human beings to give them abilities they didn't have before. When we talk about human enhancement, we're generally not talking about cosmetic enhancement because the human enhancement debate usually is around questions of living longer than people ordinarily would be able to live, or having abilities like running faster than people ordinarily could run, or thinking, faster than ordinarily people can. So those notions of what the normal capacities of human beings are. So, in other words, being thin isn't, it may be difficult for someone with certain kinds of genes to be thin. Getting liposuction allows you to be thin, but it's not outside the bounds of what most people are able to do. But yes, I think cosmetic enhancement does raise some of the same questions. And of course, there are people who are very anxious about cosmetic enhancement. They think we shouldn't be doing it. They think the doctors who do it are unethical. I think I'm concerned when people are subject to certain kinds of cultural weight. You know, they hate themselves because they have a couple extra pounds or a couple wrinkles that I don't think you should necessarily take risks with your body because of fat hatred or those kinds of things. On the other hand, I've always struggled with my own weight. I'm about 40 pounds overweight. I keep a daily food diary. I exercise every day. And if I could take a pill to get rid of these pounds that I have carried for 10, 15 years now, I would easily, quickly do it. I'm not prepared to go under the knife to get rid of these pounds because I don't think that the risk-benefit ratio is appropriate. It's not because I'm opposed to cosmetic surgery. I just don't think people with my amount of weight should be thinking about that. But eventually, I think all of us will benefit from advances in chemistry and genetic therapies that will make us thinner, more attractive according to our own diverse expectations, and more useful for longer periods of time. And that will be a good thing.
I share your 40 pounds, and I would love to take a pill.
Yeah.
But I'm not willing to be sculptured to that degree. How do you think we're doing? Can you rate the U.S., excellent down to poor or 1 to 10 or however it might do in terms of evolving with new technologies into the future? Are we doing a pretty good job as a country with our educational system and all of what that implies? Or are we just coming out of the dark ages? Or are we so-so? And how do we stand up against other countries?
Well, it depends on the area. We're not doing so well with basic health because our healthcare system is such a mess. 40 million uninsured still, 1,500 different insurance companies and different policies. We spend 10 times more on the administration of healthcare than we should as a consequence of this huge mess that we have. And so there's a lot of waste in our system. We spend twice as much per capita as other countries do and get far less from our health care than we should. Nonetheless, because of all this, medical industrial complex we've developed, there is a lot of innovation going on. And so we generate quite a few medical innovations, some of them more expensive or, crazy than they need to be. Our pharmaceutical system is, because of its intellectual property laws, it often comes up with new drugs for things that don't really do anything for us any better than the old drugs did, but are able to make a buck off of them, while the top 10 diseases in the world, malaria and diseases like that, don't have any medical research going towards them. So there are a lot of problems around that that could be fixed. But we are a very productive, innovative scientific culture still, even though we're not producing enough young scientists, and a lot of them have problems finding jobs. So, at any rate, I could go on and on about those kinds of difficulties. I think there are some other areas where we could do even much better, and one is Internet access. When we compare Internet access to places like Korea, which is a recently, had been a very poor country, growing very, very rapidly, South Korea, of course, or Northern Europe, Finland, Sweden, Norway. A lot of other countries are doing Internet access so much better, and their regulation of telecommunications is so much more rational than the way that we do it. And so I think hooking everybody up to the global brain is one of the most important cognitive enhancements that's happening today, and we're just not doing a very good job of that right now.
In your book, I think you have a line that says happiness is an elusive goal. And what does that mean? Because we all think we're entitled to happiness. But try to go out and find it is another story. But
well, the way the brain has evolved, there's a certain kind of balance of happiness and sadness that people have that's set at birth. As a part of your neurochemistry. And then there are certain processes, rational processes, that people employ that balance out their happiness in their life. So in other words, if you have a naturally depressive personality, even if you win the lottery, you're probably going to end up back depressed after a certain period of time. If you have a naturally happy personality, even if you get a cancer diagnosis, after a certain period of time, you'll probably overcome the depression of the event and of the diagnosis and be happy until the end. So those are the kind of neurochemical settings. And then there's the rationalization processes and the habituation. So you get used to things. You get married, it makes you happy for a year or two, but then you get used to being married. So happiness is kind of irrational in that way. It's not, we don't stay happy as long as we think we will, and we don't stay sad about things as long as we think we will, and we often make irrational choices around happiness. Now, one of the things I think that's of concern, one of the ethical issues that we need to address for the future, is the fact that we probably will have increasing control over our mood in the future. So happiness is currently an elusive goal because of all the reasons I just mentioned, but in the future it may be that we will be able to take a happiness pill that will permanently change our mood, our sense of optimism, or whatever it is. That could be quite problematic. I mean, the Brave New World had one set of anxieties about that, which is that if you make people happy all the time, they may not care about things in society that they should, like the fact that they're living in a totalitarian state. You could give somebody a happiness pill who's in a horrible marriage or in a terrible job, and they were directed to realize that getting out of that marriage or that job was what they really needed to do. This pill could be a techno fix that would keep them in a bad situation. And so I think we have to worry about some of those consequences.
Alan is in Houston, Texas, and he says, going back to space, do you see the potential for space research, space travel, to be a leading indicator or a door opener for the fields that you've been talking about today, or just primarily a benefactor?
I guess it would be a benefactor. I mean, the big problem, I'm not telling you anything I know, but the big problem, so far as I understand it, with space is propulsion. We need to figure out a way to get things out of the gravity well cheaply and then move them around cheaply out there. The creation of a space elevator or novel propulsion method, I think, is the principal thing that's holding us back. If we could figure out how to do that, then we'd pretty quickly be able to figure out how to shield humans from space radiation or keep their bones strong in space. I think that there have been some expectations about space in the past that are probably unrealistic about the economic utility of space, although space minerals, as I understand it, if we had, again, cheap propulsion methods, cheap ways to get things in and out of the gravity well, then space minerals could be quite lucrative. It's going to wait a while until the science, the materials and propulsion science catches up.
So more of a benefactor for the near to medium term than a leader driving the technology.
Yeah, well, certainly nothing in biomedicine is going to change the economics and policy reality around space exploration. That's not a factor holding it back, and it's not going to be a factor pushing it forward, with the exception that certain kinds of what we call convergence technology, which is the convergence between biotechnology and nanotechnology, might facilitate material science. So you might be able to create new nano materials that would be a lot lighter, stronger, and would make certain kinds of space devices, space exploration vehicles, a lot easier to build and get out of gravity. But the space elevator idea is one that depends upon that kind of a material, the creation of some kind of super strong, nano, very light steel that would be able to be hung from a satellite in space, and we could ride up and down. Otherwise, it would just be too heavy and would collapse.
What's the typical profile of your students that take classes in this subject area? Are they really pro-technology? Do they come from the sciences and the engineering, or are they all social science students? How would you describe your typical student profile?
Well, I teach in the graduate program at Trinity, which is a small public policy program, and they have been primarily people from the political and health insurance industry in Hartford. although we've had a variety of students, former Trinity students who stay on and get a master's degree, and I've had a number of police because we have a special program with the Hartford Police. So they have run the gamut in terms of their backgrounds and in terms of their attitudes towards science and technology, also generally just the same kind of distribution of attitudes and anxieties and optimism that you see in the general public. I don't know if I get that representative picture of them, since they generally tend to be deferential to my very strong opinions on these matters, and at least until they graduate from my class, they tend to just listen. But,
do you know if you've ever had bio Luddites in the class and if they change their views?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for the last couple of years, I've actually been teaching a course called Happiness in Public Policy. And so one of the issues that that I address in that course is the application of neurotechnology, the research around SSRIs and Prozac, for instance, and whether it actually is effective for depression or whether we're overdiagnosing depression. So there are a lot of people who, I think quite rightly, are anxious that the psychiatric industry is making a profit off of telling people that they're sick and that they need a certain drug when we don't even know that the drug works and that we don't know that the diagnosis is correct. So there's a certain number of bio-Luddite or bioconservative attitudes that I heartily endorse as a caution in this area. But yeah, I certainly have those folks in my classes.
Interesting. Does space ever come up in terms of technology in your classes?
Well, not in health policy very often, although I have certainly told people what you asked me earlier, which is that if we are ever to go into space, it will be facilitated by and probably require a number of changes to human physiology that will have bioethical consequence. But no, I'm afraid I don't get a chance to opine very often about space in my classes. I hope that that space becomes more of a policy issue. That would be a wonderful thing.
If we wanted to really do settlement on Mars or someplace, I've always contended that we need to be able to take our pets with us. So if we had to modify humans to live on Mars, would it stand to reason that we would have to modify our pets to do that too? And is that an ethical issue?
Well, as I said, I don't consider the things that we do to most animals to be serious ethical issues. I think, the ethical question around animals, as far as I'm concerned, and it's an argument I make in Citizen Cyborgs as well, is not to cause them unnecessary pain. So if you were to design an animal to have a heightened sensitivity to pain so that you could torture it, well, yes, I think that's unethical to do. If you're screwing around with a dog's genes so that it would stay healthy and strong on Mars, I don't think there's any ethical problem at all with that. Or even if you just screw around with the dog's genes so that it's purple and glows in the dark, I don't think there's a problem with that either.
To have your built-in flashlight or something, right?
Right.
Interesting. Do you have another book in the works?
I do. I've been working on a book far too long now called Cyborg Buddha, which is about the application of neurotechnology to moral improvement and spirituality. And so what I mean by that is that we've got this huge amount of research that's going on now in the genetic and hormonal neurophysiological aspects of moral sentiments and moral behavior, and also the way that the brain works around things like feelings of awe or being in the presence of a spiritual entity or losing the boundaries of the body in a meditative experience, all these kinds of things. And we will eventually have pills and brain devices, when we were talking about deep brain stimulation earlier, or even external to the brain devices. We have devices now called trans cranial magnetic stimulation, which focus magnets on different parts of the brain that can turn on and off some of these abilities or experiences. And so these will have a tremendous implication for criminal rehabilitation and for the control of our own behavior, you know, our own addictions, and making us more compassionate, making us more patient, more temperate, and so forth. So that's been the focus of that book, and we're going to have a conference about this topic at New York University at the end of March, a growing number of papers and books will be coming out of the project.
When does this book come out?
I'm hoping for 2012, yeah.
I do a series on the space show called Our Spiritual Connection to Outer Space, because I think a lot of people, especially the space cadets that we sort of call ourselves, have some sort of kind of spiritual, for lack of a better terminology, connection to drive us into wanting to do things in space and see space, often even in an unrealistic viewpoint. So, I'd love to know when your book comes out, and if you're willing, I'd love to bring you back on the show to talk about it.
Oh, of course.
You know, I think it would be really fascinating and interesting, to say the least. Last question is from Kimberly in Boston, and I wish she had called in or done it earlier. She says, one of the big social questions that you really haven't touched upon is if you're able to modify humans, however you do it, to live longer and to possibly have a longer period of productivity, you're throwing off the entire equations of how people retire from jobs, get jobs, how the workforce accommodates the people that are able to work. So if we're all living longer and if we're all more productive and capable longer, how do we make room for the younger people to come into the workforce when our society is becoming more and more technical and we don't need as many laborers?
It's an excellent question, and it's one that's a very central concern of the IET, which is the organization I run, IET.org.
IUT?
IEET.org.
Okay.
Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. And we have ongoing project around what we call structural unemployment. And so we talked earlier about the Luddites.
Right.
The Luddites went around smashing machines because they were being thrown out of work. If you look at the proportion of the American population that has been of adults in the American population who have been employed, after World War II, when women started to enter the labor force, it went up steadily to about 68% of the U.S. population until the year 2000. Since the year 2000, there has been a steady decline almost every month, but certainly every year, of the proportion of Americans who are unemployed labor in the country. Now, one of the reasons that that's happening is that the growth of computerization and automation is eliminating whole swaths of different kinds of labor. So, you know, the president mentioned this in an offhand way recently in an interview. He said, well, one of the reasons why employment's not coming back in this slump that we've been in is because of automation, and he gave the example of ATMs and bank tellers.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you look at what's happening in the country, bank consolidation and the banking crisis that we're going through now, all kinds of bank tellers are losing their jobs. Travel agents, you look at every single sphere of our society, middle management, everybody's being impacted by this. So that's one of the things that's happening. Now, your caller raises another dimension of this, which is that, okay, if people start living longer, we won't be able to afford to keep somebody on Social Security for 50 years, right? As when Social Security was created, people only lived to their late 70s at best. Now they might live into their hundreds. And that will be another dimension of this crisis. And then if you say to them, well, we're going to start raising the retirement age, we're going to start raising the age at which you can, we're going to keep forcing you into the labor force, when the jobs are disappearing already. So we basically need a wholesale reassessment of the relationship between jobs, income, retirement and education in our society. Because as long as we try to make sure that people only get to eat if they work, and the jobs disappear because of automation, then we're going to be in a serious crisis. Our economy won't work. So we need to, one of the things that we advocate is for what we call basic income, that everybody, as a right of citizenship, should have a right to a certain level of sustenance from society. And then if you want more, you have to work for it. But, you know, the level that we have now, especially since the workfare reforms of the 1990s, is inadequate for what most people would consider basic. But that's a hard argument to wage when the Tea Party is on the rise. But basically every single social protection that Americans have needs to be extended to a basic entitlement of citizenship.
How are we doing on that? Not very good, I would imagine, right?
Well, yeah, given the debates over the last couple of years when the right wants to take away Social Security, Medicare, the basic entitlements that we have hard won over the last 50, 60 years, launching a new argument that says that everybody needs a basic income is a hard one to wage. But I think I've been very heartened by the Occupy Wall Street movement and its manifestations in every sphere of politics now, that we may have a new political conversation very shortly.
I want to thank you very much for being on the program today and talking about these issues and Citizen Cyborg and being able to apply some of it to our main themes on the space show, which are space travel. And I wish you a great holiday season, a good 2012, and a happy new year. And thank you again for being a guest on the space show.
My great pleasure.
Okay, and listeners, no show Sunday, back Monday, open lines, 7 p.m. California time. Thank you all for listening to today's Space Show program.